Term care experts. To register, go to www.alzfdn.org/tour.
Survivors Speak Out, Confronting Abuse and Sexual Violence in Left Movement. A teach-in Saturday, October 16th, 3 to 6 p.m., streaming on YouTube. The forum will address what abuse and sexual violence is, the harm it causes survivors and grassroots organizations, and those individuals committing it. Guest speakers include Pam Africa of International Concerned Family and Friends of Bumia Abu-Jamal, Dr. Mark Lamont Hill, Esperanza Martel, Dr. Bandy Exley, Gabriel Bryan, Dr. Robin Spencer, Bumia Abu-Jamal, Dr. Johanna Fernandez, and survivors. To join the conversation, go to our Facebook page, Survivors Speak Out, or go to bringbumiahome.com. We will not be silent.
In communities all over the country, there are battles going on. Sometimes this battle is a war of words, but lately it's becoming more and more violent. At the center of the conflict is critical race theory. Join me, Bernard White of UPAMA, and Jamel K. Doner, Associate Professor of Education at William & Mary, Tanya K. Hernandez, Professor of Law at Fordham University, and David E. Kirkland, Professor of Urban Education at New York University, as they answer your questions and present the reality of critical race theory. Become a part of this online discussion Saturday, October 23rd, from 2 to 4 p.m., For free registration, contact upamainc.org/events. That's upamainc.org/events as we present Critical Race Theory, the Facts and the Fiction.
On October 24th from 1 to 4 p.m. at Richard Tucker Park on 66th Street and Broadway, Crossways Theater presents a Stop Anti-Asian Hate Play titled COVID Crime. Speakers Shirley Ng from Asian American Legal Defense and Education Fund and Jackie Wang from Welcome to Chinatown. Free. Peace cranes will be distributed.
Yo, this is G Love on WBAI, New York, New York.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning and next Saturday, we will hear an interview with no less than Frank Herbert, author of Dune. But first, some words from Dan Persons. Stay tuned.
I'm Dan Persons, and this is my Hour of the Wolf review. I took a guess while watching Snake Girl and the Silver-Haired Witch, a Japanese gothic horror film that just got a release on Blu-ray. And I thought that maybe it had debuted sometime in the mid-50s. After all, it's shot in black and white, and it's about a young girl who's reunited with her family after an extended time in an orphanage. So you figure if you have a 10-year-old girl in 1955 Japan, you can do the math and come up with a good reason why she might have been separated from her parents 10 years prior. But actually, the film was released in 1968 and directed by none other than Noriaki Yuasa, the director of quite a few Gamera films, including the original black and white one some 3 years prior, which kind of explains the black and white at this late date, but still. Anyway, there's a lot that remains mysterious about this film, including its target audience. Based on a manga series by Kazuo Umezu, Snake Girl tells the tale of a young girl, Sayuri, played by Yashi Matsui, who discovers her family reunion is just a little off-kilter. Her father's career centers around venomous snakes. Exactly how I'm not sure, but it requires very poorly secured snake containers and keeping a vat of highly corrosive acid on tap. Her mother is suffering from amnesia and is hiding away an older daughter, Tamami, played by Mayumi Takahashi, who is overtly hostile to sweet, loving Sayuri, and who may be part snake or bitten by a snake and so acquiring the powers and abilities of a snake. Take that, Stan Lee. Something like that. And yes, there's also a white-haired witch lurking about who doesn't do much real witchcraft, but is none too fond of Sayuri either. Kid can't catch a break. And this is supposed to be a kid's film, actually, because that's the sandbox where director Yuasa typically played, but it's hella intense for a kid's film. There's beautiful, shadowy, noir-inspired photography by Akira Uehara, who also did a few Gamera films, but whose work is otherwise obscure to me, and some genuinely disturbing nightmare sequences that make the most of some lo-fi but cleverly deployed camera tricks. While there's no real gore, the violence and threats raining down upon poor Sayuri are pretty over the top. There's a moment where Tamami rips a pet frog in half, just to make a point. The Snake Girl and the Silver-Haired Witch is a curious experience overall, a gothic fantasy that repeatedly veers into dangerous terrain, which, of course, makes it all the more worthwhile, at least for me. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons.
Thank you, Dan. This morning we're setting the Wayback Machine all the way to 1976, on the occasion of the book launch tour for Children of Dune, the third in what was thought to have been a trilogy. And the interviewee is none other than Frank Herbert himself. The entire thing runs longer than this program, so we'll hear it between this week and the next. About halfway through the interview, we were joined by Margot Adler, which lends some serious weight to the discussion. So, let's begin.
I'm sitting in WBAI Studio A talking with a person who I really wanted to meet for a long time by the name of Frank Herbert, who is author of Children of Dune. Santaroga Barrier, Destination Void, Dragon in the Sea, which goes under about 20 other names. What else? What books would you...
You want a complete list, right?
Yeah.
What books would you like people to read?
Well, you're going to science fiction. How about Eyes of Heisenberg?
Heisenberg, mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. I read that as Heisenberg's Eyes, I think.
That's okay.
I'm just trying to remember.
How about Hellstrom's Hive?
Hellstrom sci-fi. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Soul Catcher.
Yeah.
How would you classify that?
Soul Catcher? It's a novel.
Okay. Do you disdain the term science fiction?
Nope, not at all. I don't take part in the argument about mainstream, new wave,
old wave. I don't take a part in any of these arguments. I think they're nonsense arguments. A lot of people argue about mainstream and science fiction. I think what you do is you write the best you're able, no matter which category you choose. And the difference between them is the difference between jazz and classical.
Max just pointed out, if I had interviewed him before, why was I happy to meet him? So this must have been the first interview.
Use the same notes, the same notation, and many of the same instruments. Which do you prefer? What a nonsense question. Sometimes I like classical, sometimes I like jazz. It depends on the mood I'm in at the time.
When you are in one of these moods, do you set out to write a particular kind of novel?
Oh, I always plot very strongly, very heavily, and in depth. I always do deep characterization. I have file folders with each character's name on it and the data in it. I may bring a character on stage at age 30 on page 40 of a novel, but I'll have a file folder wherein I've taken that person's history back to year one and earlier. I know who his parents were, when he was born, what trauma he suffered growing up, where he went to school,
his first sexual experience, everything.
I would like to see the file of Pander Olsen.
Pander Olsen? Well, you know who Pander Olsen is, don't you?
Well, it's an obvious anagram to people who are familiar with science fiction.
Yes, Paul Anderson.
Right.
Well, we play this as a kind of a game, you see. I have another character in there who in one of my books called Holjans von Bruck, who is a very famous science fiction writer. You don't know. John Holbrook Vance, who is not Henry Kuttner, who is
not Bruce J. Friedman.
Were you aware that Bruce J. Friedman wrote some softcore pornography under the name Jack Vance?
Oh, my God.
Yeah, just to confuse matters.
Yeah. Well, Jack is a very real person, a great writer, and one of my closest friends.
Really?
Yes, but we play these games with each other every now and then. In fact, Paul and Jack and I plotted a story one time while we were building a houseboat down in the San Francisco Bay Area. We were going to write the story together. It didn't work out that we would, but we...
But we did get a nice name for the author, who would be the three of us, and that was Noah Arkwright.
I like that.
Well, let me ask you something about the file of Pander Olsen, because he appears, I've noticed, in at least two different things. He is a biographer of St. Dahlia of the Knife.
Mm-hmm.
He is also a lawyer who... who attempted to defend the tactful saboteur.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, this machine is having issues playing back this tape. It is squealing. If I had the mic on in here while this was playing, it would sound like a banshee. And there's no remote start, so I have to go, about 10 feet away. Bear with me while I... this up.
Who attempted to defend the tactful...
Now, you hear that? My voice was never that deep. Okay, so... let us try this.
The saboteur in the same name. McCree, I think his name was.
Mackay.
Mackay and Watt.
Mm-hmm. George X. Mackay.
Well, we're going to try George this X. for a while.
What does the X stand for? I'm
curious. Xavier. Javier.
Javier. Has Mr. Olsen done any other things already?
Well, you must realize that because Pander Olsen began as a kind of an in-gag between Paul and Jack and I, that he serves only one function. He is an archivist. He is somebody we refer to when we want some little
erudite datum to come in, or some special ability which nobody else has, you see, such as an expert on a particular area of law. Mm-hmm. It's a joke we have with each other. We're all very good friends.
I was wondering if you might take one of those files originally intended for one particular stage, as you put it, and put that person on stage somewhere else.
No, not really. I'll keep a character for a particular kind of story where the same name and the same persona apply.
Mm-hmm.
But I won't change, bring that character into another story without some changes that fit the other story. You see, when I write, I don't write the way a lot of other writers tell me they write. It's more like composing.
Because I plot heavily, I plot in depth, and I'm writing, I'm carrying quite a number of threads through any given book,
mm-hmm.
several levels. You might have an adventure story, it might have a psychological suspense line through it, that sort of thing, you see. And I'm very conscious of the rhythms that are necessary for any given moment in a story. Do I need short sentences and a lot of action verbs here to pound the action along? Do I need passive voice here? Do I need reflexive moments with long, involved, and convoluted sentences? It depends, you see. The demands of the moment in the story, the demands of the story, kind of negotiate this.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to backtrack a little. I was looking over various aspects of different biographies. I've seen a few, none of which conflict, fortunately, but which show a gigantic diversity. And I was wondering if you might, in 5 minutes or so, tell us the story of your life.
Well, first place, every writer I
Isn't
know...
Isn't that a ridiculous question, by the way?
Yes, that is a ridiculous question.
But I mean,
why don't you go stand in the corner while I answer it?
Large room.
Every writer I know who thinks of himself as a professional writer has a mind like a sponge. And I not only have that, I have a mind full of odd, small items of data. But I also like to go and see for myself.
Mm-hmm.
When there were lots of questions about Vietnam, I went there as a war correspondent.
For which paper?
For the Hearst Headline Service.
Mm-hmm.
I've done a documentary movie there.
I wasn't aware.
With my wife. I won't pull that joke again, I promise.
You can guess.
No, I may as well do it. We have an in-joke in the family that we have the only two draft-age boys in the United States who sent their mother to Vietnam. But my own feeling is that if you're going to write about it, do it. If you're going to write about flying, fly. I'm a pilot. If you're going to write about diving, dive. And so I have a lot of things I've done. But essentially, I'm a writer. The diversity is picking up grist for the mill.
Mm-hmm.
You see? And so the diversity you read in the in these sketchy biographies in the books, they were interesting at the time, the things I've done. And sometimes I did them to support myself and my family. Sometimes I did them because I just wanted to. Does that answer your question? I mean, I'm not going to go in enormous detail. You can find that elsewhere.
What professions have you had that you've not yet incorporated into books that you think you might like to?
Oh, I think you use everything. You don't hold back anything. If a moment comes when you need knowledge about pressure datum planes and under the sea, you use it.
Do you follow what I'm saying?
You pick up what you have.
You don't have little congeries of information in your head, not if you're a whole person. You may, for the purposes of writing a book, build up a fragmented personality of yourself. Each little congery in your head is another character, and so for the duration of the book, you're a fragmented person, little schizoid, because you're playing 9 or 10 roles. But when the book's over, you come back to Earth.
How did you research, and this is plunging right headlong into deep aspects of your writing, how did you research how one would live in, say, Siege Tabor?
I lived in the desert.
And please correct my pronunciation.
Siege Tabor, yes.
Siege Tabor.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the first place, Siege is a word that originated in the Caucasus, where there was a real language called Chukotka, which was a hunting language used by the Muslims of the Caucasus.
Mm-hmm.
And they were people with a cave personality because they lived in cave enclaves, so I studied about them. I lived in the desert. I went to every source I could find about cave personalities or congested living, because it's not just necessarily a cave warren that you have. It's a warren, you see. It's where people live very close together. And it's very likely that the city, as we know it as a place where many people are very close together, was invented in the Middle East. That is, it originated there. And so I did a great deal of study of the Middle East and the way people adjusted to living very close together, and large numbers of people very close together. I also wrote for the purposes of being ecologically explicit in the Dune trilogy, I wrote created an ecological language and a script for it. The script was a pictograph script, and I contend that most of the scripts we use in the world today began as pictographs. And so I wanted that in my psyche when I did it. All of these things went into it. I've done the things, some of the things. I haven't lived in a cave, but you don't really need to live in a cave to get that feeling once you've immersed yourself in all the data.
What are some of the roots of the words in the language of Arrakis?
Most of the roots are Arabic. And I had a multiple reason for that. I used an elision process to change some of them. Languages change. English is a very fluid form of communication, which is changing yearly, daily, sometimes hourly. Radio and television are influencing this. And I did a great deal of research into comparative religions. And so, of course, I could not overlook Muslim and its Arabic roots. And so I used Arabic. One of the major reasons is that for our culture, if you're going to say desert, you think Arab. You see. And they have a marvelous culture. They were ecologically sane long before any other culture ever even thought of it. They had spoken and unspoken rules. For example, they would not build habitations on arable land.
Now, there are other words like, and I know I am going to lose of the pronunciation.
Don't worry about pronunciation. Kwisatz Haderach.
Thank you.
The Kwisatz Haderach comes right out of Jewish mythology, the Kabbalah. And again, another religion.
Now,
there's the mysticism, you see. And the Kwisatz Haderach in the Kabbalah, or Kabbalah as it's pronounced, is a person who can be many places at once, who has this capability. So I just I took it right out of the Jewish mythology.
And put it in the mother religion of...
Well, you see, the mother religion here is an amalgam. As most religions that we have now are.
Mm-hmm.
We've just lost some of their roots. Christianity, for example, doesn't admit to its roots in Mithraism, but they're there for anybody who wants to look for them.
Mm-hmm. What religions mostly go into the B'nai Gesserit?
Well,
that I must have mispronounced.
I used Bene Gesserit because I was thinking of female Jesuits.
Aha.
They were kind of my model. well, of course, Christianity. Sunni, the Muslim mystics. Sufism. Zen. Buddhism out of Gautama. In other words, prior to Zen. Islam, of course. Islam is a very strong element of the whole trilogy.
Mm-hmm.
We tend in this culture not to study Islam and not to recognize how much it has contributed to our culture.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the religious wars out of which our present consciousness has come, the awareness. But we owe Islam enormous debts of gratitude.
Would I be right in detecting a smidgen of pagan witchcraft of more or less the Gardnerian tradition?
Oh, the golden bough is there, of course, yes.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's a very good way of putting it.
The mother goddesses and so on, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because the person for whom I'm substituting, Margot Adler, is very involved in study and pursuit of Gardnerian witchcraft.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a feeling people listening would be, as I am also, really interested in what goes into the religion B'nai Gesserit. And, I mean, if it were here, I certainly couldn't join, but I could certainly follow it mentally.
Well, you know that I'm contending, in, not just in this book, but in several books, that that we can implant a religion.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's noted that the B'nai Gesserit would be constantly putting slogans of thought, slogans of ideas.
They would be sinking concepts into the unconscious of a population.
Before something would happen.
To prepare for any problem that might arise.
Mm-hmm. Is this being done?
Do I think that this is being done in our world?
Yes, I do.
Oh, I do too. I think that certain power enclaves in our society do this consciously with protective forethought.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that it's fully protective? Or in some cases...
Well, I think they believe it protects them. But I believe it's like a double-edged sword without a handle. If you grasp it hard enough to use it, you're going to injure yourself first.
Mm-hmm.
You'll be the first victim.
Right. Mm-hmm. Which is... yet that doesn't... The B'nai Gesserit, however, are far more wise. At least, I have a feeling they may not be, because I'm only to a certain degree into Children of Dune. It appears that something may have backfired.
Well, remember this, that as far as the whole trilogy is concerned, I was taking an unexamined assumption of our society mm-hmm. and holding it up to another kind of examination. And that assumption is that if a hero is good for us, the superhero must be better for us. And my contention is that every superhero that Western society has had has left the society poorer.
Mm-hmm.
And that many of the characteristics of the superheroes tend not to surface. They tend to be suppressed. It's unusual when the things that might draw down opprobrium about a superhero surface later. Look at Hitler, though. He lost a war, you see. If he had won, he would have been a superhero. He destroyed his society. Look at Kennedy. Kennedy was one of the worst things that ever happened to this society because people followed him without question.
Mm-hmm.
They did not question what he was doing. The nature of the superhero in Western culture just has not been examined in what they do to a culture. And so I was examining that in this trilogy. And that makes a lot of people uncomfortable because the hero doesn't come out like the heroes usually do in Hollywood stories, where they walk off into the sunset arm in arm.
Well, I've discovered that immensely. I recently read The Santa Rosa Barrier,
mm-hmm.
and the end of that book, I tried to pick up another book. I couldn't. That had me shivering.
Well, let me tell you about the Santa Rosa Barrier. I wrote it very carefully to be a wedge in the stream, so that the people who read it would, about half of them would think I was talking about a utopia,
mm-hmm.
and about half would think I was talking about a dystopia. I balanced it in that way.
Mm-hmm.
And here is another thing that's not very often examined in our society. We tend to, in this society, think that the only thing keeping us from utopia is another law or we haven't invented the right machine yet.
Mm-hmm.
And this is utter nonsense. Great societies are great because of the character of the people they develop, not because of the laws they have.
Mm-hmm.
A society with too much law is going to be a poorer society.
What about a society with no law?
Well, it depends on what their basis for motivation is, whether they are motivated with out of respect for each other.
Mm-hmm.
And in that sense, maybe there is a law, you see.
Mm-hmm.
It depends on how you look at what we perceive of as law. How do you perceive law? Our society tends to look at law as a cure-all. And it isn't. It's a dead-end street.
How did previous societies, in that case, how did law originate?
Well, I think
that's
a
better question.
I think law originated as a religious inhibition, and it had organizational motivation. What were the necessities of the society in which the law originated?
Mm-hmm.
And you'll have to note that for societies that where religion was the law, to break the law was to sin.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a very strong unconscious damper on everything that the people do. We tend toward that in our society. We tend to make the law religious in its intonations, and to our detriment.
Yet I note that there is a sort of law of the freemen that fits in to their...
It helps their survival in their surroundings.
Very much so.
Yes.
And the desert mouse comes along.
But where their society changes, where their surroundings change, then the laws have to change. They have to adapt. And if the laws are rigid, and especially if the laws are seated in religion or are looked on theologically as they are in our society,
mm-hmm.
we build a theological aura around law in our society. where that happens, then the law tends not to change, to adapt to new conditions, and it injures the society severely.
Well, for those that did not follow Muad'Dib, and there were many,
mm-hmm.
Were they sinners?
Well, in the eyes of the jihad, of course they were sinners, you see.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yet, now, the jihad succeeds.
Of course.
And Princess Erlan is sitting there moping, and the only other word I can think of is not arable. but in a sense, cuckolded, more or less, by her husband. It is a marriage of convenience that
mm-hmm.
she wants to be a real marriage.
Mm-hmm.
Yet she is supporting that religion. She is building that up and...
Think of her conditioning.
Okay.
She was conditioned by the Bene Gesserits and by an imperial family. She had her duty.
But that duty to the Shaddam reign, mm-hmm. Did that just disappear?
No, it was transmitted legally to Paul, you see.
Mm. And their and legal mm-hmm. part is that all
that
really
that was the
really
law
mattered.
And the duty now, you see.
That seems to be more, in that case, of law turning into religion as
that's
opposed
exactly
to...
That's exactly what I was dealing with.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It sort of seems to be a reverse of what has happened here.
Mm-hmm.
I find that totally fascinating.
Although, you see, it's cyclic. We originated... our law originated in religion, came out of religion into a conscious attempt to manipulate society,
mm-hmm.
and then went back into its theological cocoon, where it is now, in our society.
Mm-hmm. And to where will it go?
Where will it go? I think it's cyclic. I think it'll come out again.
You think it will?
Oh, yes.
Where would you like to see it go?
Well, I would like to see us become more pragmatic in our dealings with deep motivations, deep psychological motivations in society. I don't favor, for example, a gratuitous increase in drug use in the society, but I do think that we don't deal with drugs with any kind of sensitivity, with any sensibility, with any rational response.
Mm-hmm.
Our society is composed of people who seem to need a mind changing. We've lived with alcohol for thousands of years.
Mm-hmm.
Alcohol is a drug, and it is probably one of the most dangerous drugs that we have in the world today. It causes a lot of deaths. It's very addictive. It creates enormous problems in our own society. It's creating enormous problems in the Russian society right now. We found that prohibition doesn't work. What prohibition did in our society was give organized crime the capital base so that they could shift to other drugs when we legalized alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
Now we, you see, trying to prohibit these things does two things. It throws them into a criminal control. And it increases the number of people who use them, people seeking the thrill.
What was the thrill of the original people who discovered Jaspers in Santa Rosa?
In Santa Rosa Barrier?
Mm-hmm.
It was the thrill of a unified social action, very much linked to something like a Jungian collective unconscious.
Mm.
Do you see?
Yes, I think mm-hmm. I do. What proposals would you take to decrease drug usage, dangerous drug
well,
usage?
Well, we know where most of the new users come from. They come from present users building a market to support their own habits.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a really simple way to reduce drug use in the society. You take the criminal profit out of it.
Mm-hmm.
England found this. The United States ought to look at that very carefully and get off its Puritan high horse and solve the problem for the society. We would have fewer addicts if we would legalize, to a degree, legalize drug use and for those who are actually addicted, make their fix available to them for 50 cents at the corner drugstore. We'd have far, far fewer users than we have now.
And what would you think...
This would not solve the problem as people conceive of the problem, you see. It would just reduce the arena in which it operates. The problem in New York is not drug abuse. It is the cost of the drugs and the ancillary crime to support that cost.
Mm-hmm.
You see, that's the problem. And the answer is obvious. You take the profit out of it. You reduce the cost.
Okay, at this point, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back in a few minutes.
You're tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio in New York City, WBAI at 99.5 FM. We will continue with this interview shortly. Frank Herbert, during his book tour for the launch of the novel Children of Dune from 1976, and we were joined by Margot Adler. I dare say with even all the hullabaloo of the release of the third screen version of this novel, you have not encountered an interview of this depth and breadth. Frank was live on the Today Show that same morning, was granted a bit under 5 minutes of broadcast time. And so it goes with commercial TV and the like. But the difference here is at WBAI. We tend to not go in for soundbite interviews on our live radio or arts programs, and I dare say that by the time you've heard the whole interview, which continues in a moment and then next week, you may attain an understanding of just who Frank Herbert was, how his writing evolved, and I promise you, Margot Adler makes sure that we get into the religious and political aspects of the novel. And that is possible because we are listener-sponsored radio, and we respect our sponsors. That's you, or at least they should be. So I'm asking you to take a moment out and make a pledge to WBAI by calling 212-209-2950 or visit wbai.wedid.it.org to make a recurring monthly donation and become a WBAI buddy. And when you're asked what your favorite show is, don't forget Hour of the Wolf, now in its 51st year of broadcasting. And now, let us return to 1976 with Frank Herbert, Margot Adler, and myself, Jim Freund.
A production company in Paris, France, bought the rights to it.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Camera One. The producer is Michel Seydoux. The director is Alejandro Jodorowsky.
Mm-hmm.
Jodorowsky, I talked to on the telephone the other day, and apparently the production, having spent more than $2 million on a $9 million budget, has been put on the back burner for about 8 months while they look up a new distribution contract, while they try to tie down distribution.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know enough about the movie industry to know if that's sensible, but that's what I've been told. I have seen the script, by the way.
You didn't write it.
I did not write the script. Translating a book into film is really a translating process. You translate it from one language to another.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not absolutely sure that the author can do the best job.
Of translation.
Of translating, that's right.
But
you need somebody who speaks that language intimately.
Well, I'm one of those people that takes a look at a book that I really enjoy, such as Dune. And somebody, I think it was first 2 years ago, mentioned to me, they're going to be making a movie of Dune. My first impulse was, oh no.
Well, Jodorowsky has produced a script which follows the book carefully.
Does it follow the characters?
It follows the characters. The character development, I'm not sure because I have not seen film. And character development is a process that happens on the screen, not in the script.
Mm-hmm.
Which is another difference in between film and the written word. But the script itself follows the book. The character indications follow the book.
Mm-hmm.
The visuals are magnificent.
Where are they filming?
The last thing I saw was that they were going to do the principal photography, that is, with the actors, in Algeria.
Mm.
Now, with this hiatus, I do not know what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
They have 2 years, by the way, in their contract to produce a film.
Mm-hmm.
Two more years. Yes.
So there is yet a good deal of time.
Yes.
Now, is the script, would you call it linear as opposed to what Jodorowsky had with El Topo?
Linear? Well, it's linear to the degree that the book is.
It is.
Yes.
That was one of the more important questions to me, because he's an absolutely fascinating director, using different techniques, and
his visual imagination is superb.
Yeah.
He has the eye of a camera genius, and with a genius, anything can happen. You can have just a magnificent film or a sensational flop,
mm-hmm.
but you're not going to have anything in between.
Mm-hmm. Have you thought of your other books in terms of movies? I think that Santa Rosa Barrier would be magnificent.
We're going to be negotiating a contract on Santa Rosa Barrier tomorrow.
You are?
Mm-hmm.
That's good news. Who would be directing that?
Well, I'm not at liberty to say anything at all about it.
Okay. I'll just say this. Recently, comparing the movie version of the book The Man Who Fell to Earth, mm-hmm. by Walter Tevis, or Tevis, I'm not
Tevis.
Sure. Tevis. To the film, I thought that was a very well done adaptation. With Santa Rosa Barrier, you have a movie that requires next to no special effects.
No.
Could be done on a normal budget. In fact, almost below budget when you consider normal nowadays means.
Well, as they say in Hollywood, you could bring it in for a mill.
Yeah. Okay. But there, the scripting is really going to require a great deal. And I'm not so sure that it's going to be a question of just transferring to the screen.
Well, remember this, that the screen, that the film does not get into the mind of the character easily.
Mm-hmm. Who we're seeing through the window is the woman whose program I'm substituting for, Margo Adler. who I think is going to come in.
You know what I mean by that? That you
mm-hmm. okay,
Margot, she's tiptoeing.
Do you want to take a seat and join in on this? It's your show.
Are you sure?
Okay, we'll edit that out.
Anyway,
so.
Just as character development happens on the screen, so does what's going on unconsciously. Mm-hmm. Have to happen on the screen. It has to be visual. And you can't have people stand up as they used to do in Shakespeare's day and march to the edge of the podium and say what he's really thinking is, and then tell you what he's really thinking.
Well, the visuals of the mind's eye are still, to me, the most impressive. John Brunner termed it as, they build the nicest sets.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And there I would say that it would be the original writer.
Well, it's the difference between radio and television. With radio, the reader's or the listener's imagination must be enlisted to its fullest.
Yes, which is why I love
radio. I use an example of out of pre-TV radio,
mm-hmm.
of a joke on Allen's Alley. Where his character comes back from India, and Alan says, did you get any new jokes? Or, no, excuse me, I'm misleading you. He said, did you learn any new tricks in India?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is, oh, yes, here, I'll show you. First I lift my left foot. Now I lift my right foot. And then there followed the longest dead air. I was tempted here to just replay it. You see, just time goes by and nothing happens. You wonder if the studio has caught fire or the tower has been toppled or something. And then, very distant in an echo box, Jerry Colonna says, "Well, don't just stand there. Somebody get me down." Now, your mind will go along with the gag, and you'll see him drifting off in the corner of nowhere. You see, far more dramatically than if you had done it visually. If you did it for television, it'd fall on its face. You'd say, "Where are the wires?"
Absolutely. But
this is an example of what I mean. In a book that is, and people can see me wiggling my fingers to say in quotes, mm-hmm. down to earth as the Santa Rosa Barrier.
It's so relevant.
Well, I still see the original dialogue, the original action from the book being there as it is in the book without somebody meddling and say, well, needs more sex. Or
I certainly hope so.
show a little blood when that truck falls.
Yeah.
That is a case in which I would really only like to trust the original author.
Or trust the discretion of the translator. And there are some good movie translators around, you know.
Yes, but they're limited. You see, frankly, you'll find that I just don't trust producers.
Well, I'm not talking about producers. I'm talking about directors.
Producers, okay.
Yeah. We have, I've done a script, for example, for Soul Catcher. And we may have a movie deal on that before too many weeks have passed.
Mm-hmm.
I'm satisfied with the script that's been done about Dune. I think it's well done. Very well done.
Who did Jodorowsky hire? He did it himself.
Mm-hmm. Probably with some of his creative crew help, but I'm sure that Jodorowsky dominated it.
If you were to have seen something in there that you didn't like, that you said, no, this is not the novel that I set down on paper, set into celluloid or whatever, mm-hmm. What could you or would you do?
What could I do? Well, I'm in the contract as technical advisor.
Oh, you are?
And I'm sure they would listen, mm-hmm. and they might even react favorably. But I'm not one of these people who would stand there tearing my hair saying, oh, my God, what you're doing to my baby. Because that's not the way it goes. I just couldn't emphasize too much, too strongly, that it is a translating process. It's as though you were translating into a foreign language.
Mm-hmm. What other media would you like to work?
Oh, I'm in the media I enjoy.
Well, you've worked as was it a TV news commentator?
I was a radio news commentator.
Radio news commentator. And I believe you've done some work on television.
Oh, yes. I've been I've had a little experience with television commentating for the old Don Lee network out in the West Coast.
Mm-hmm. Mm. But in the creative aspect, where would you like to break into?
Where I am.
Just writing.
Yeah. It's what I do best. It's where I feel I belong. It's where I enjoy doing what I do best. Why should I do anything else?
You have been listening to Hour of the Wolf,
My name is Jim Freund. Part 2 of that interview with Frank Herbert airs at 7 a.m. next week, October 23rd, where we'll start getting into some of the geopolitical aspects of Dune. Don't forget to support WBAI by making a pledge at 212-209-2950 or visiting online at wbai.wedid.it. Stay tuned for any Saturday with David Rothenberg. Good morning.
Good morning. You're tuned to 99.5 FM, WBAI in New York. Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund came to you on recording over listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio, WBAI in New York. Coming up is Any Saturday with David Rothenberg at 8 o'clock. Please stay tuned.
Hi, this is Julian Joiello, and I'm a listener and supporter of WBAI. I'm a student at NYU, and I live in New York City. And I want to shout out to the other young listeners of WBAI. We have to help keep the station going, and the easiest way to do it is through the WBAI Buddy System. If you donate as little as $10 a month, you have proactively promoted free speech radio. Go to the website WBAI.org, click the donate button, and make a difference.
Hi, this is Hannah from WBAI's Premiums Department. As you may know, WBAI now has a new phone number to call to make donations or to pledge for premiums at 212-209-2950. Thank you for being a WBAI member and for making a contribution to keep the station afloat. But if you have a question about a premium, please do not call that number. All the call center can do is take down the info and send it to premiums@wbai.org, and time on the line costs us money. Instead, please email us directly with your question or concern. The email is premiums@wbai.org or call 212-209-2870. We promise to get back to you within a week's time. Again, please call 212-209-2870 if you have a question about a premium you ordered, or email premiums@wbai.org.
Dear WBAI listener, we can certainly use a little help from our friends. After years of falling behind under new management, Pacifica has now gotten its financial papers in order and can apply once again for grants. That means WBAI, which is owned by the nonprofit Pacifica Foundation, can also apply for funding. And we are looking for a pro bono grant writer to help our 61-year-old station by writing grants for us. If you have time, expertise, and interest, please contact Bertol, our station manager, at bertol@wbai.org. You'd be helping to ensure the stability and growth of this historic listener-sponsored radio station. With details, please email bertol@wbai.org. That's B-E-R-T-H-O-L-D, bertol@wbai.org, with grant writer in the subject heading. Many thanks. Many, many thanks. This is listener-sponsored WBAI New York.
I believe that we have got to mobilize a larger movement to reclaim the democracy.
Radio broadcaster Bob Law.
Some of y'all have underestimated the value and the appeal of white supremacy. And you have no idea how strong white privilege and white supremacy is.
Tune in to From the Streets with Bob Law, which gives voice to a wide range of black and progressive political and cultural perspectives. That's 11 to noon Saturdays here over listener-sponsored WBAI New York. This week on WBAI Playhouse, the story is set in the 1920s when Cuban immigrants in Florida rolled cigars by hand and listened to the words of the lector, who read stories out loud to keep workers entertained and sometimes drove them wild with passion.
What is happening in the novel has been happening to us. No, don't you look at me that way.
But old ways are under attack in this Pulitzer Prize-winning drama, Anna in the Tropics.
I am a distant relative of the cacique, the Indian who used to translate the sacred words of the deities. The workers are oidores, the ones who listen quietly, the same way the Taino Indians used to listen. And this is the tradition that you are trying to destroy with your machine. Instead of promoting and popularizing machines, why don't you advertise our cigars?
Anna in the Tropics by Neo Cruz stars Jimmy Smits. It's produced by LA Theater Works, and it's being featured this Saturday evening from 8 to 10 p.m. on WBAI Playhouse, right here on listener-sponsored WBAI New York.
Survivors speak out, confronting abuse and sexual violence in left movements. A teach-in Saturday, October 16th, 3 to 6 p.m., streaming on YouTube. The forum will address what abuse and sexual violence is, the harm it causes survivors and grassroots organizations, and those individuals committing it. Guest speakers include Pam Africa of International Concerned Family and Friends of Bumia Bujamal, Dr. Mark Lamont Hill, Esperanza Martel, Dr. Bandy Exley, Gabriel Bryant, Dr. Robin Spencer, Mumia Bujamal, Dr. Johanna Fernandez, and survivors. To join the conversation, go to our Facebook page, Survivors Speak Out, or go to bringmumiahome.com. We will not be silent.
Hard work is how we support ourselves and our families. The jobs we do are a big part of who we are. And our jobs keep America going. Yet, the job site is where we have the least power. Many of us voiceless as corporations gamble away our health and our family's future just to feed their greed. It's time for the working class majority, for you and me, to regain our voices, to turn up the volume, assert our collective power, and to organize. Join me, Rick Smith, every Saturday night from 6 to 8 p.m. right here on WBAI 99.5 New York as we bring the class war and fight for a better future. The Rick Smith Show, every Saturday night, 6 to 8 p.m. right here on WBAI 99.5 New York's listener supported radio. For more information, visit WBAI.org.
This is Julian Assange. You're listening to WBAI New York. Stay strong and keep listening.
You've got to start off each day with a song. Now, even when things go wrong, you feel better, you even look better. I'm here to tell you that you'll be a go-getter. Now the way that you shake my hand will tell me how I stand. Now isn't it better to go through life with a smile and a song than walking around with a face 11 miles long? Now you know that you can't go wrong. If you start off each day with a song, you've got to start off each day with a song.
Or sing it, Jimmy Boy.
Even when things go wrong,
sing it for the hoi polloi.
You feel better, you'll even look better. Ah, that music, it does something to me. I wish I knew what it was. Last night I was telling Umbriago about my latest concerto called Tony's Pushcart. He said, Tony's Pushcart, how does it go? I said, it doesn't go, you have to push it. I got a million of them, a million of them. Now you know that, so you can't go wrong.
Yeah.
You start off each day with a song. You've got to start off
beats. Boys, please, soft, soft, a little more fortissimo. I want to relate a yarn. Turn back the pages of history and what do you see? Madison Square Garden or Odeon. And there I was, interviewing a prize-winning cow. I asked her to tell the radio public how she feels. She said, moo. She's contented, I'm contented, but her husband ain't. So what happens? The bull ups to me, I ups to him, and without any preliminaries, I'm flat on my back. Being a gentleman, I apologized. But the bull's not satisfied, he demands an autopsy. So I grabs him by the tail, and what happens? He flips his tail, I lands on his head. He flips his head, I lands on his tail. He's playing ping pong with me, and I'm losing. Just then the bull is ready to charge again. I gets an idea. I start singing south to the border down Mexico way. And what happens? The bull starts crying. But irregardless, I keeps on singing. This time with the castanets. That's too much for the bull. He collapses. A cheer goes up. I'm saved. And the moral is, you gotta start off each day with a song. You've gotta start off each day with a song.
Oh boy, you're singing now.
Even when things go wrong.
Oh, Jimmy, you're a wow.
You feel better. You know, I'm walking down Broadway and who taps me on the shoulder? My pal hit him in the head, Schwartz. I said, who are you working for now? And he said, the same bunch, the wife and their kids. Now, isn't it better to go through life with a smile and a song than walking around with a face 11 miles long? Now, you know that, so you can't go wrong.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Start off each day with a song.
He's Jimmy Durante. I'm David Rothenberg. And let's get the FCC commitments out of the way. I'm David Rothenberg. The program is any Saturday at 99.5 FM, listener-sponsored radio, WBAI. That satisfies all government commitments that we make every half hour, whether you like it or not. What a silly rule. I mean, you know what it is. I mean, if you say it once, it's there. Well, things are looking brighter about the pandemic. Brighter isn't the word. Less desolate. The Times did a story that the figures are down pretty much around the country. The Delta numbers have decreased. Vaccinations are going up. There are still the resistors, to my everlasting frustration. I heard a program on this station, and they were talking about the deep state. I figured it out. That must be Idaho, has to be the deep state where all the conspiracies are happening. And I did mention that I have an old, old friend who is from the school of conspiratorial beliefs who moved to Idaho. He said no masks and no vaccinations, and he felt free. I wear a mask and have a vaccination and feel just as free here in New York City. I feel freer because less people are getting ill, fewer people are dying. That's a sense of freedom. And on the program that I heard, there was some misinformation, or not misinformation, it's the kind of thing that clouds the issue, saying that the numbers of deaths have been inflated to scare people, and that many of the people who died, particularly the elderly, died of other causes. Well, what we were told over and over again is if you had other ailments, you were much more vulnerable. So the people who have had diabetes, a heart attack, or are on chemo, certainly in the early days when New York was struck so severely, that the cause of death could have been COVID, COVID could have just exacerbated the problem. It may have not been the specific cause, but why argue over the figures? It reminded me years ago, I met an out-and-out fascist who disputed the figure of 6 million Jews. And I said, well, nobody was keeping count. There was no admission into the gas chambers keeping an accurate total. I said, but if we give you 4 million, do you feel better? Is your moral conscience elevated if it's 4 million instead of 6 million, if anybody could come up with an accurate count, which they can't? I feel the same way about the figures with COVID. Much more specifically, I have two friends, close friends, who in the past week attended funerals of people who died of COVID, both unvaccinated. And one friend, she told me that her cousin was out of state, was a hospital worker, a healthcare worker who got COVID. who got the, I mean, she was in and out of places where people are sick. And she had been well, and she had been a frontline worker, and she wouldn't get vaccinated, and she died. And then another person said to me, one of the email insistents that I, insisters that I get, said, you want people with vaccinations to get sick. I don't. I want them to get vaccinated and stay healthy, to stay well. And go across this country. I would like to find everybody who's not been vaccinated. Have they ever snorted coke? Do they take marijuana? Have they taken Viagra? Did they take penicillin when they had syphilis? Have they injected alien serums into their body or drugs into their body? And suddenly, when we have this international plague, they have become scientists, and someone like Nicki Minaj is giving suggestions. Well, I did my pandemic number. It is certainly frustrating, and I guess we just have to hope that enough people come to their senses. In a state like Idaho, where my longtime acquaintance went, no masks. No vaccinations. He's better than, it's better that he's not the governor like Greg Abbott in Texas or DeSantis. Abbott and DeSantis, they're the Abbott and Costello of politics. All right, enough of the pandemic, Mike Fetching. We'll move on. I have to get the pandemic out of my system every week, but I also have to get some music into my system. So let's start it off with Johnny Mathis and L. Carter song. Jonathan Larkin wrote this. For Rent, you know the story of Jonathan Larkin, this young man who wrote a musical, which was done originally at the New York Theater Workshop and then was moved to Broadway, and he died a week before the show started previews. I had worked with Jonathan Larkin in a show prior to that, to his Rent. It was in site specific, and it was a musical, and the actors actually sang and performed down on the steps of one of those buildings on Wall Street. I can't remember. Somebody might know. It's one of those right across from the Stock Exchange. And it was all outdoors, and they were mic'd, and it was fascinating. And he was a kid who wrote a musical about it. And then he wrote Rent. And here's Johnny Mathis and L. Carter from one of the great songs from that classic, now classic Broadway musical.
Minutes, 525,000 moments so dear, 525,600 minutes, how do you measure a year, in daylight, in sunsets, in midnights, in cups of coffee, in inches, in miles, in laughter and strife. In 525,600 minutes, how do you measure a year in the life?